It's about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 2nd, 2007, a national day of mourning for the late former President Gerald Ford. Hello, I'm Joy Cardine, inviting you to join our discussion remembering Gerald Ford, the 38th President of the United States who passed away 1 week ago today at the age of 93. Funeral services will be held at Washington's National Cathedral this morning. Gerald Ford will be laid to rest tomorrow in his hometown of Grand Rapids, Michigan. What will be the legacy of Gerald Ford? He wanted to be remembered as a president who helped the country heal after Watergate. Is that how you remember him? We are told that just about everyone advised him not to pardon Richard Nixon, but he did anyway, believing that the country could not move on, could not move forward until that was done. Did he do the right thing? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Toll free from anywhere. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email, as we welcome your thoughts, your questions, your recollections of President Gerald Ford, his life and legacy. Our guest this hour is John Orman, professor of politics at Fairfield University, the author of several books, including Presidential Accountability, Comparing Presidential Behavior, and Celebrity Politics. And Professor Orman joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks a lot for being with us. So, Gerald Ford was called the accidental president, was in an office that he never sought.
That's right. Mm-hmm. He was President Nixon's second choice. The first choice was John Connally. After Spiro Agnew had to resign for failure to pay his income tax in October of 1973, Nixon was thinking of appointing John Connally. He was the Democrat, as you know, who was turned Republican, and he was a supporter of President Nixon. And President Nixon finally realized that he couldn't get John Connally through a Democrat House and a Democrat Senate. You have to have a majority vote in the House, a majority vote in the Senate. So he picked somebody who was very popular, especially in the House of Representatives. He picked Gerry Ford.
Yeah, why was Gerry Ford so popular?
He was the House Minority Leader. He was a good guy. Members both sides of the aisle liked him. And President Nixon knew that he would sail through the confirmation hearings. I believe one of the questions they asked him at the confirmation hearing, would he ever consider a pardon of Richard Nixon? And President Ford, at the time, was a representative from Michigan, and he said no, he didn't think he would ever do that.
Is that right? Well, then 30 days later...
Yes, he changed his mind. He became our first appointed vice president in 1973, and then, of course, August 9th, 1974, he became our first virtual appointed president, and then he turned around and appointed Nelson Rockefeller to be his vice president.
The oath of office, one of the first things he said, and the thing that maybe he's most remembered for, our national nightmare is over.
Yes, he took office August 9th, and he said our long national nightmare is over. For about 30 days, his presidential press secretary then was named Gerald Terhorst, and the media would ask him every day, is President Ford going to pardon Richard Nixon? And Terhorst said, no, I've talked with him. He's not going to do that. He's not going to do that. And then about 30 days later, he totally surprised Gerald Terhorst, his press secretary, and he made the decision himself. He pardoned Richard Nixon, and also when he did that, his press secretary, Gerald Terhorst, resigned because he felt like he couldn't be honest with the media. And the new press secretary was Ron Nessen. That's how Ron Nessen from NBC News got to be the presidential press secretary.
I didn't remember that. Let's hear what the former late President Gerald Ford had to say when he announced, I believe it was on a Sunday morning, he surprised the nation with this announcement.
Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted, and by these presents do grant, a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon, for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed or taken part in during the period from July 20, 1969 through August 9, 1974.
Yeah, and Professor Orman, is it true he virtually stood alone in deciding to do that?
Yes. Clearly, a majority of Americans, at least 80 to 90%, were against the pardon. It's the first time a person has ever been pardoned before they're indicted. Another way to do it would have been to let President Nixon be indicted, go into a court of law, have all the charges brought against him, swear under oath, and have the whole story of Watergate come out. And then after he was convicted, maybe many people would have said, okay, you can pardon him now. You don't have to send a president to jail. But President Ford thought that may have taken 1 year or 2 years to have a trial of a former president. He didn't want Nixon to have to go through that. He also wanted to get Watergate behind him. He didn't want to wallow in Watergate. He didn't want to have a big international trial where the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China would send reporters over to cover the trial of an American president. So in order to get Watergate behind him, he just totally pardoned Nixon before he even had the formal indictment from the Justice Department. And it was unprecedented. A lot of Democrats were caught off guard. They had to look up the power of the pardon power in the Constitution to make sure it was absolute. And Ford showed it was so absolute that you could even pardon a person before they're indicted.
Yeah, and his popularity dropped like a rock, didn't it?
Yes, it was about 75% before the pardon, and it must have dropped to the high 50s. Of course, it was much higher than what President Bush has today, but it was in the high 50s, and he spent a lot of points on that. It was very unpopular then, but in the early 2000s, in the 00s, Caroline Kennedy, she has an organization, Profiles in Courage, and she gave Gerald Ford the prize, saying that his pardon, you know, looking back some 30 years later, stood the test of time. And that basically was a signal for Democrats. If they wanted to, they could say they still, like President Ford for his pardon of Nixon. But it's still really controversial. Historians will have to sort it out. At the time, it was very unpopular. Today, in retrospect, to some people, it makes a lot of sense. I'm still in the minority. I'm one of the people that believes that Nixon should have been indicted. We should have had the trial, and then I would have accepted a pardon.
Yeah, and it still hasn't been sorted out, though. We hear that the consensus now is that the pardon did help us heal.
Yes, that is the way we're looking at it now. Another way to look at it, though, is that future presidents saw that no American president would go to jail no matter what they did. Later on, you remember we had Iran-Contra with Ronald Reagan. Mm. We had Bill and Monica. We've had a number of presidents who always knew that if Richard Nixon did not go to jail for what he did, there'd be very little chance of them going to jail. So it set different messages. Nixon, as you know, was the only person pardoned. Everybody else who did actions in Watergate in Nixon's name ended up going to jail. So some of those people were not very happy campers.
Yeah. Did the pardon of Richard Nixon cost Gerald Ford the election in 76?
In a real close election, Gerald Ford made a great comeback. He almost won. If he would have won Ohio, I believe he would have won the presidency in 1976. There are a lot of other factors. We had inflation around 6 or 7%. We had something called the ridicule problem. We'll probably get into with Chevy Chase and the way the media covered President Ford. Plus, also, it was a Democrat nation. There were way more registered Democrats than there were Republicans. The Democrats controlled the House and the Senate. So another way to look at it is Ford, after 2 years and 5 months, almost won his first election. He came very close. But, of course, in America, we magnify victory. We magnify defeat. And Ford was thought to be a loser.
No. Talk a little bit about how he was portrayed in the media. I mean, we all remember the Saturday Night Live skits where he was, you know, Chevy Chase was falling down all the time.
Right. President Ford had a very open presidency. Richard Nixon was isolated. He didn't give many press conferences. He had a bunker-down mentality. When Gerald Ford came in that first day, he toasted his own English muffins to kind of give and invited the press in to see him make his own breakfast to show that he was just a normal person. Later on, we found out that that was the only time he did that during his presidency. But with an open presidency, the media is following you around 24 hours a day. And with President Ford, we got to see him stumbling, coming off an airplane. We got to see him falling down skiing at Vail, Colorado. Mm-hmm. We got to see him hitting his doubles partner in the back with a serve. We got to see him slicing a drive and hitting a woman in the head.
Oh, no.
So,
I mean, the point being that because the cameras were on him at all times,
yes,
that we saw these things.
Right. So, yeah. And usually today, if President Bush would do something like that, it might be a page 7 story or maybe the 7th item on news. The national news covered that, in the top 1, 2, or 3 stories. Look what President Ford has done today. And then Chevy Chase started picking it up, and he started becoming a bumbling, stumbling idiot on Saturday Night Live. And that was the portrayal of President Ford. There were jokes that he couldn't walk and chew gum. He played football too long at the University of Michigan without a helmet. And really, it was kind of unfair because, in my opinion, Ford was one of our most graceful and athletic presidents we've ever had. He was a great football player at the University of Michigan. As an older gentleman, he participated in a lot of sports. It's just that the camera and in the new openness after Watergate, you want to make sure that you have your eyes on the leader, because we had not had our eyes on President Nixon. Ford got caught many times making mistakes. He went over and met Mr. Begin and shook his hand. He said, "I'm very happy to meet you, Mr. Sadat," at the time who was Begin's mortal enemy. And Ford was in Iowa one day, and he said, "I'm very happy to be here today in Ohio." And he had to be quickly corrected. So he made some verbal mistakes, but they were caught on film. And it even got so bad in 1975 in September, there were 2 assassination attempts against him in California. And in one of the attempts, you see him stumble. He's really dodging a bullet. He's so quick. You know, here's our American president. He's dodging a bullet. And since he didn't get killed, later on when you see a compilation of President Ford walking, and they'll show him stumbling, but they forget to tell you it's an assassination attempt, and
yeah,
people are shooting bullets at him. So it's okay if my president stumbles.
And he got out of the way. Yeah.
So Ford was, it was just part of the new way we started covering the presidency.
We're talking with John Orman, professor of politics at Fairfield University. We are remembering Gerald Ford. Today is a national day of mourning for former President Gerald Ford. His funeral services are going to be held at Washington's National Cathedral. A bell will toll 38 times for the 38th president. We are looking back at the life and legacy of Gerald Ford and welcoming your thoughts, your recollections. 1-800-642-1234 and your questions for our guest. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. After 5, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. Ben talking with an expert, looking back at the major trends of 2006 and a look ahead to 2007. Gerald Celente, who is the editor and publisher of the Trends Journal, will be Ben's guest today after 5. We are remembering Gerald Ford on this National Day of Mourning for the late president and his funeral in Washington, D.C. today. Right now, his remains are on the way from the Capitol Rotunda to the National Cathedral. The national funeral will begin at 9:30 our time in Washington, D.C. We have open lines right now to hear from you, your thoughts, your questions about the legacy of Gerald Ford. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our guest is John Orman, professor of politics at Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. And he is the author of many different books, including Presidential Accountability, Comparing Presidential Behavior, and Celebrity Politics. I heard on NPR News, Professor Orman, that the musical selection, one of them that will be played at the president's funeral today, is Fanfare for the Common Man. Was he the common man?
Yes, he was from Grand Rapids, Michigan. He had a choice to play professional football or go to law school. He decided to go to law school. He rose through the ranks in the House of Representatives, and the pay wasn't that great. So he had a home in Washington, and he had one back in Michigan. And he was sort of in like the Harry S. Truman-type mold. The average common person, we'd like to think, who did a pretty good job. And he gets a lot of points for being very humble. He wasn't flashy. He wasn't a great orator. He wasn't like John Kennedy or Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton. He didn't have a lot of flash and pizzazz. But he was a very good government technician. On television, he used to have crazy sentences put together for him, and he couldn't deliver them very well. But behind the scenes, it's been reported that he could give a briefing on the budget to members of the press without notes, and he knew all the budget categories. And, of course, the media is really not that concerned about details mm-hmm. and decimal points. And so here's a very smart man willing to talk to them about the budget process. He'd been on budget committees, and he knew everything about sort of like veto messages and the process of government. But that wasn't a very good story to cover.
Yeah. You know, I one of the things I remember most about him, I was certainly, a teenager or younger when he was in office, but I do remember what a close relationship he had with his wife. And in fact, his wife was maybe as well known, if not better liked than the president.
That's right. Mm-hmm. One of our first outspoken first ladies was Eleanor Roosevelt. And after Eleanor Roosevelt, you have to kind of wait till Betty Ford. Pat Nixon was not outspoken. Jackie Kennedy was a very good political asset. She was charming and had a lot of style, and she could speak many different languages when John Kennedy would travel abroad. So she was a great political asset. But Betty Ford would talk about issues once in a while. She made a big issue nationally, of course, when she dealt with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. She made a difference when she started talking about substance abuse and opened the Betty Ford Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
She also talked very openly about, she hoped her daughters were taking protection. Mm-hmm. She was sort of like a modern woman, and she announced that she was going to sleep in the same bed with her husband. And it was sort of like, again, if Gerald Ford was the common man, she was, the common woman living with her husband in the White House, and she didn't want to change just because her husband was president. She didn't want to change her routines or her family. And the big important thing for Betty Ford was family.
Yeah.
And so we have this long love story. I believe he's died at 93, and I think she's 88. And we have this long love story, and it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember her speaking out, I think, in favor of passage of the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yes.
When he was, she would publicly disagree with him on various issues.
That's right. Alice Paul, the woman who wrote the ERA in 1923, she was still alive. She didn't die until 1977. And in 1976, Betty Ford gave her a phone call in a nursing home and wanted to tell Alice Paul that she supported the Equal Rights Amendment and hoped that it would pass. At the time, it had 35 states. And it looked like it was going to pass. It just needed three more states. But, of course, a woman named Phyllis Schlafly came along and organized a group called Stop ERA. And she was able to freeze 35 states instead of the 38.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let's start taking some calls as we remember the late former president, the 38th president of the United States, Gerald Ford. Richard in Neenah is with us first. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to pick up on a couple of comments that were already made. One is really kind of silly, actually. You talked about the quote about maybe he played football too long without a helmet.
Yeah, I think Lyndon Johnson said that.
That's mm-hmm. what I was going to say. I thought it was LBJ.
Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there.
Right. It shows Johnson's disdain for Ford.
Right, right. Which, you know, as the Senate Majority Leader, you could see where he was coming from.
Right.
But more importantly, regarding that, his decision to pardon Nixon stood the test of time, according to some people.
Yes.
Well, I think one possible impact, and of course there's no way to actually determine this, is some people who were involved in the White House at the time, and specifically I'm thinking of Rumsfeld and Cheney. I don't know if Gates was there yet. They got the lesson. They got the message. If you're high enough in power, you're immune. And, I mean, those guys are plenty arrogant already, I'm sure. but having it reinforced with Nixon's pardon may have led to some of the situations we're in today.
Yeah, that's an interesting view. I agree it may have influenced Reagan and may have influenced Clinton, knowing that Richard Nixon didn't have to go to jail. And I have no way to assess yet about Cheney and Rumsfeld, but we do know that Gerald Ford gave this famous interview in 2004 to Bob Woodward, and it could only be leaked after President Ford died. And in that interview, as you know, he was very critical of Cheney and Rumsfeld. And it was kind of interesting. Before this interview came out, all the media was saying, Gerald Ford, here's the man that brought us Cheney and Rumsfeld. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's not a positive. But then you can even see the president, he decided to tell Woodward that the war in Iraq was a mistake. In his opinion, he never would have done that. He was sorry that George Bush did it, and he was really upset the decisions that Cheney and Rumsfeld had made. But, of course, his loyalty to his Republican friends made him embargo that interview. And that'll be judged by historians. You know, in 2004, should we have a former president speaking out? Because a lot of people have lost their lives in 2005, 2006. So I understand what you're trying to say.
Yeah. And actually speaking out from the grave, even.
Yeah.
Donna in Appleton. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy. I'd like to suggest that one of the reasons we were able to get out of Vietnam in a timely manner, or in the manner in which we did. In other words, Nixon had started making some overtures about getting us out of Vietnam. And I think if we had gone through a two-year or more trial for Richard Nixon, that we would have delayed getting out of Vietnam.
Professor Orman?
That's possible. At the time, in 1974, in August, North Vietnam hadn't made their big push into South Vietnam yet. That started happening in around 75. But Gerald Ford was our first American president to decide not to go back and get involved in Vietnam. He made the determination that South Vietnam wasn't that important to our national security. Nixon got us out in January 1973. Nixon made a promise to Nguyen Van Thieu that said if North Vietnam ever came down and tried to take over South Vietnam, he would be back. But Ford didn't honor Nixon's pledge. And, of course, Ford was in a position he couldn't have. We had a Democrat House, Democrat Senate. They would cut off funding in a second. And so Gerald Ford made the decision just to leave Vietnam. And historians will be talking about that. He got really mad when people said he was the first American president to lose a war. But for Jerry Ford, I think most Americans at the time were happy that he did not try to go back into Vietnam. And there might be some lessons today.
Yeah. We had a caller on a previous program who was very upset that Gerald Ford was there when the fall of Saigon happened. He did order the withdrawal at that time, or the complete withdrawal at that time.
He didn't have a choice. North Vietnamese troops came into Saigon. They took over our embassy, and Ford said, "Come home." And so we have those pictures of the helicopters and people hanging onto the bottom of the helicopters, and we have 400 refugees getting on barges, and only holds 100, and it sinks out in the water. And, of course, the musical Miss Saigon, you see that helicopter scene. So that was one image. But Gerald Ford's only option at the time would have been to unilaterally, as president, go over and stop bombing North Vietnam. And the House and the Senate, the Democrats, wouldn't have let him do that. So he made the determination that was all he could do. Another thing that some conservatives are mad about Jerry Ford, he was one of our most open presidents. He was our first president to allow the CIA and the FBI to be investigated. In 1975, the CIA and FBI revelations started coming out. Seymour Hersh and the New York Times wrote two big stories. And Gerald Ford said, "How does Seymour Hersh know this?" And he called William Colby out to Vail, Colorado. And Colby said, "Mr. President, somehow Seymour Hersh has tapped into the family jewels." And Ford said, "Well, how many more stories possible are we coming out of this?" And Colby said, "Well, there could be 1,000. So Ford said, "I want to see the family jewels." Mm. And Colby had to show him. And when Gerald Ford saw the history of the past wrongdoing of the CIA from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, he ordered Nelson Rockefeller to look into all past wrongdoing of the FBI and the CIA, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And he wrote a really good report. But that wasn't enough for the American people because it was Republicans investigating the CIA. So the House had the Otis Pike Committee redo the Rockefeller Report, and the Senate had the Frank Church Committee redo the Nelson Rockefeller Report. And this is the only way we know about past wrongdoing. So I give Ford a lot of points for openness, our first president to say, okay, let's see what the CIA has done. And Ford issued an executive order that's still on the books today that says no employee of the U.S. government shall be involved in assassination plots against foreign heads of state. Other presidents, you know, are kind of angry at that, but nobody's issued an executive order to override that. So Ford came up with a number of sort of like mechanisms to, mm-hmm. to make the CIA and the FBI more accountable. And conservatives are mad at him for that.
Yeah. Another revelation that came from those interviews that he did in 2004 and 2005, I don't know if this one was with Bob Woodward or not, but he came out very critical of this warrantless wiretapping and the NSA surveillance program, saying that he would not have authorized that, but maybe, you know, maybe the times were different. He was he tempered his comments a little bit.
Right. Ford was in an era where after the House and the Senate had failed to check Lyndon Johnson and failed to check Richard Nixon, they put in a number of safeguards. We had the War Powers Act. We had the Case Act, which said presidents had to tell the House and the Senate what their secret executive agreements were with foreign heads of state. We had a number of acts that tried to give Congress a little bit more control and accountability and oversight of the president. And so Ford, in his time, he wouldn't have been able to do that, but he was really probably commenting on maybe he thought President Bush and mm-hmm. The OOs have may have taken too much strong executive authority that had been unchecked by the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Ford, coming from the House, even though he was a House minority leader, was very strong in his support of the institution, and he thought Congress should be an equal partner with the president in strong decisions.
Next, we go to Don in Sparta. Hi, Don. You're on the air.
Hi. I have heard no network program, no one except maybe Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Discuss Ford and Kissinger's trip to Indonesia, where Nixon had been giving a lot of weapons to the dictator Suharto and Sukarno, and were told they were supposed to be just used for defense, but they knew that they were getting ready to attack East Timor, and Ford and Kissinger said, well, look, that wouldn't look very good if you did that while we were here in the country. Wait till we get out of here. Do it fast so that it doesn't attract too much attention. And subsequently, one-third of the population was wiped out. There are parallels to that, along with the Iraq situation, where we build up a dictator, then tell them we don't care what they do through April Glaspie in the case of Iraq. Then there is a disaster afterwards. This should get a little bit of coverage, I think.
Do you know much about that, John?
No, I agree. Timor should be a negative when you assess President Ford. Another one in the same region in Indochina would be the mass slaughter that went on in Cambodia after we had bombed Cambodia in 73 and 72. It was the socialists came to power, and we thought all of Indochina would turn communist, but of course we didn't realize that there are different brands of communists. So the Vietnamese and the Cambodians right away, the Cambodians declared war on the Vietnamese, and they started fighting. So we had genocide going on in Cambodia, and much like in the 1990s when we had genocide in Rwanda, and much like today when we have genocide in Darfur, American presidents are silent. So I'm sure historians and presidential watchers and political scientists and citizens, you know, are going to ask someday, what did you do when all this was going on?
We're talking with John Orman, professor of politics at Fairfield University, author of many books, including Presidential Accountability, Comparing Presidential Behavior, and Celebrity Politics. We're talking about the late former president, Gerald Ford, who died at the age of 93 a week ago today. Today is a national day of mourning in honor of the 38th president of the United States. Funeral services will be held at Washington's National Cathedral this morning, and then the former president's remains will be flown to Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he will be laid to rest on the grounds of his museum in Grand Rapids, Michigan. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your thoughts and questions, your remembrances of Gerald Ford. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Do you remember him as the president who helped the country heal after Watergate? Do you remember him as the president who pardoned Richard Nixon? How do you remember former President Gerald Ford? Do you remember him as the common man, the honest, open, bipartisan consensus builder president? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. In her 9 o'clock hour, she'll be talking with the author of The Coming Draft, The Crisis in Our Military and Why Selective Service is Wrong for America. We're remembering Gerald Ford this hour on this National Day of Mourning for the late president, the morning of his state funeral in Washington, D.C., talking with John Orman, professor of politics at Fairfield University, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. David Eau Claire is with us next. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Good
morning.
Really enjoying the discussion, and I think it's great just to look back at some of that recent past in politics, and I think sometimes we don't do enough of that, just looking back at kind of periods that now we can see some of the results of. But I'm pretty much a progressive, but I have a respect for former President Ford, and although I did disagree with the pardon decision because I feel like anything of that magnitude should be decided by the representatives of the people. And so I think it's regrettable not to have resolved that issue through the courts, and I thought the guests had good comments on that. And my one question was, what would the guests say would be any domestic policy successes for President Ford? Because it seemed as though the domestic policy was the issue that might have turned the 76 elections.
Right. For the first part of your question, I agree with you. I think we're in the minority, though. I think that President Nixon should have been held accountable. I think he should have been indicted. I think we should have had a trial. I think everything should have come out under oath. Nixon should have had to testify and give us the full story of Watergate. And then if you wanted to as president, I think you could have pardoned him so he didn't have to go to jail. But I thought the pardon was way too early. The second one, his domestic policy. You're right. The American people were really upset. They thought inflation was runaway inflation at 6%. And when Jimmy Carter ran against him in 1976, Jimmy Carter created something called the Misery Index, where you take unemployment and you take inflation and add it together, which is totally spurious, but you add it together. And Ford had like about 12% misery, what Jimmy Carter would say. Of course, Carter forgot to how to calculate it in 1980 when he ran for re-election.
Oops.
Because the misery index was about 24%.
I bet, yeah.
So when the American people were complaining with 5 and 6% inflation, little did they know by the end of the decade we would have inflation at 11 and 12%.
Yeah. I remember Gerald Ford had that Whip Inflation Now campaign that was not very successful.
No. He wanted to give a speech, I believe it was in the Midwest, to the future farmers of America, and he asked for national television time. And he was going to tell the students and the future farmers of America and the American people, in order to fight inflation, we had to wear these buttons called Whip Inflation Now. And the media thought that was totally ridiculous. Most American people thought it was ridiculous. And he's our first American president to demand media time and be turned down by the major networks. So that started later on. Sometimes they make judgments. Now you can just watch it on the cable stations. But the major networks used to carry any time a president would ask for media time, they'd automatically give it to him. And Ford was our first president turned down because he was going to give a Whip Inflation Now speech and ask us to wear wind buttons.
Yeah, did he have any domestic policy successes?
Well, when you hear people talk today, they say that the economy was recovering and Ford did a great job in 75, 76. But as citizens living through that time, I don't think a lot of people would remember that.
But it's basically in comparison to how bad the economy got. So you could say that the economy was okay. It was coming a little bit out of, some heavy inflation. But it was a big problem for Ford, the economy, the pardon of Richard Nixon, the ridicule problem, and then he cemented it in the foreign policy debate. They asked President Ford, when he was debating Jimmy Carter, was Eastern Europe controlled by the Soviets? And he said, no, Eastern Europe is free and independent of all Soviet domination.
Oops.
And the reporter, hearing an incredible gaffe from President Ford, gave him another chance. And he said, sir, do you mean to say that Poland, Romania, Czechoslovakia are free and independent of all Soviet domination? And Ford looked right into the camera and said, yes, those states are free and independent of Soviet domination. Carter started laughing. The journalist smiled. And that was called the Polish gaffe. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, for 2 years, people had been saying Gerald Ford was like Curly of the Three Stooges. He couldn't walk and chew gum, those kind of things. And this kind of cemented it going into the election. The next day, Ford tried to recover, and most citizens didn't buy it. What Ford said was, what I meant to say last night in the debate was, the spirit of independence in the Polish people's heart will never be ceded to the Soviet Union. So if people were kind, which they're not, they could say Gerald Ford was 3 years ahead of Lech Walesa, 4 years ahead of Pope John Paul, and 5 years ahead of Ronald Reagan. But, of course, nobody's writing that now.
Right, right. David, thanks for the call. Bruce in Baraboo is with us now. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Good morning. According to the Capital Times, Gerald Ford was offered a $3,000 contract by Curly Lambeau to play for the Packers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he later took part in the Cornerstone Lane ceremony of the Green Bay Packer Hall of Fame.
Wow, I did not know that. I knew he had an offer from Green Bay and maybe Detroit, I'm not sure, maybe the Bears, but he decided to go to Yale Law School. As you know, as you mentioned, pro football salaries then weren't what they are today, but it showed a person who was really a very smart man deciding to make his career through law and politics, even though he was an excellent football player by all accounts.
Yeah. Thank you, Bruce, for that reminder. Could have been a Packer, but decided to go into law instead. Bob in Appleton. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yeah. Gerald Ford was the leader of the Republican Party that I belong to. He was pro-choice.
Yep.
He was pro-ERA. That was the Republican Party that included Jacob Javits,
yep,
Melvin Laird, Nelson mm-hmm. Rockefeller.
Right.
The Senator Danforth from Missouri. And people need to remember, Ronald Reagan, when he ran against Gerald Ford, the leader of his Southern effort was Jesse Helms.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan said to all of the Southerners who were opposed to civil rights, who were opposed to affirmative action, he said, come into the Republican Party. And all these Dixiecrats, people who were highly bigoted, flew into the Republican Party, because there was no Republican Party in the South. And that changed the nature of the Republican Party. The other thing that Ford was totally opposed to, and frankly, President Bush the first was opposed to, was supply-side economics. When Gerald Ford knew that the country needed the pardon, in his opinion, he pardoned Nixon, and he knew it would end his political career. When George Herbert Walker Bush saw runaway deficits, he endorsed a tax increase because that was what was necessary to bring deficit spending under control. But George W. Bush has gone back to supply-side economics, which has never worked. Yes. The other thing that I think people need to understand.
Now, Nate, thanks very much. We got a couple of big points here that I want to get our guest in on. Professor Orman, what about Ford and supply-side economics?
Well, I was going to say his earlier comments are, I thought, right on the money.
Mm-hmm.
Money, yeah, talking about mm-hmm. economics. But, yeah, it was a different Republican Party. And as the caller remembers, Ronald Reagan ran for the presidency first in 1968. He lost to Richard Nixon. But in 1976, Reagan made the greatest challenge ever of an incumbent president. He fell about 100 votes short at the convention. Of course, Ford wasn't an elected president, so you could say he was a weak president. But there was a tremendous challenge, and Reagan almost got the nomination then. He went to Louisiana, who had been pledged to Ford, and he asked the Louisiana conservatives to go back on their pledge, and they wanted Reagan, but they went ahead and voted for Ford. So Ford just barely won. Now, he wasn't going to put Reagan on the ticket. He dropped Nelson Rockefeller from the ticket. He got to be vice president, continue, but he dropped him from the ticket, and he put Bob Dole, a conservative from Kansas, on to kind of bring the party together, the moderates and the conservatives. Later on, President Ford, in some of his statements in the 90s, said that was one of the worst mistakes he ever made, and he felt really sad that he had been talked into dropping Nelson Rockefeller, the liberal Republican from New York. He said he should have kept Rockefeller and run that way, but of course it was his decision. So supply-side economics, I agree with him. Ford was not a supply-side economic person, and I agree with his other comments.
Yeah. Was Gerald Ford a, I don't know, a liberal Republican?
I wouldn't go that far, but I would call him a moderate Republican. He, you know, supported civil rights legislation. He did not want to get rid of abortions. He and his wife, Betty, were ERA people. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say, you know, I don't usually word my use the word liberal for Republicans, but he was a moderate, socially progressive Republican.
Mm-hmm.
But also, again, he almost won that election in 1976. He just barely lost to Jimmy Carter. And a few things could have gone his way, and he would have been a president who was elected. But as it was, he served 2 years, 5 months. John Kennedy served about 2 years, 9 months. And in our minds, it's John Kennedy, you know, one of the top 10 presidents of all time. And then we have Gerald Ford, who's somewhere in the middle of the pack.
Yeah, that's where he's going to go down in history as just sort of a in the middle of the pack kind of president?
Right, he's going to be, I've had to give a grade like a B minus or a B. He was certainly, since World War II, I think, in my opinion, the best Republican president was Eisenhower. And I would say Ford, in my opinion, was the second best Republican president. But those are my political values. Other people would say Reagan is the best Republican president from since World War II.
Yeah. Did Gerald Ford pardon Nixon knowing full well or believing full well that this would cost him the election?
I don't know. I do know that a lot of people thought there was a deal. And Gerald Ford was our first American president to accept an offer from the House. We had a committee to investigate, was there a deal? And they were threatening. They were thinking they're going to have to send him a subpoena. But they just invited Gerald Ford, and they said, would you come up to Capitol Hill and talk about whether you made a deal that Nixon would resign as a quid pro quo, you would pardon him so he wouldn't have to go to jail and he could keep his government pension. And Ford just voluntarily walked in and sat down. And Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman from New York, she was really very upset, and she said, President Ford, there's a lot of evidence that there was a deal. And he said, believe me, there was no deal. All I had to do was wait a couple of months to November, and we would have had a trial, and he would have been removed from office, and I would have become the president then. So I wasn't in any hurry to be president, so I didn't think the pardon was part of the deal. But a lot of historians, especially when you read Al Haig's memoirs and read other people who talked about it, Nixon was told that if he resigned, there was a possibility of a pardon.
Interesting, because I in one of the speeches or one of the interviews that Ford did regarding this issue, the way he parsed his words was interesting. He said, in my mind, or as far as
right,
I was concerned,
there was no deal.
There was no deal.
Yeah. Right. There could have been a deal. That doesn't mean it was illegal. It certainly sounds unethical. But historians are still going to have to sort that out and figure it out.
Yeah, we had a caller who couldn't stay with us who wanted to know if Ford vetoed very much legislation.
Yeah, I think, if I can recall off the top of my head, at least 60 vetoes. He vetoed a lot of legislation, and he would make the House and the Senate go back and work on it. And he had, short, to-the-point veto messages. He didn't do anything, to my knowledge, President Bush does. President Bush does a signing statement where he says what he understands the bill to mean. And sometimes he understands the bill to mean exactly opposite of what the House and the Senate say. For example, on the House and Senate might say there's no torture, and President Bush will sign a signing statement saying, well, in my opinion, there might be some torture. Gerald Ford didn't do any, in my opinion, any signing statements that totally disregarded the intent of the bill. In fact, if he didn't like the bill, he would just veto it and make the House and Senate override his veto, which they didn't very much.
Yeah, the caller's specific question was, did he veto more than Nixon? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I'd have to look that up. There's a great book by De Gregorio, The Complete Encyclopedia of the American Presidency, and have all the statistics in there. But I don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah. I mean, but he was, both were dealing with, was it a democratically controlled Congress at that time?
Yes.
Yeah. So in any case, what he was vetoing Democratic legislation, anything of any particular import that that he vetoed that we can look back on today and wonder what if?
No, I don't remember those, which particular vetoes he did, but I do know he vetoed around 60 or so.
Yeah. So in the, I guess, how do you see history treating Gerald Ford in the years to come?
Well, we find out when presidents die, at least for the first month after they die, there's usually a tremendous outpouring of sympathy. When Richard Nixon died, I believe it was 1994, people went 1 month before they even mentioned the word Watergate again, and it was all the presidents showed up, and it was how great Nixon was. The last time we had a president die, Ronald Reagan, we treated it as almost as if an incumbent president had died. It was 1 month. We had flags at half-staff. Everybody went, in my opinion, just incredibly overboard, but they were paying their respects to Ronald Reagan, and nobody mentioned Iran-Contra. But with Gerald Ford, we're having a sort of like a very respectful period, remembering what he did, remembering his decency, his openness, his honesty, how he tried to heal America. And I think the statements that are coming out now, nobody's going out of their way to magnify Jerry Ford. I think they're saying the positives and they're saying the negatives. But overall, I think he was an important man, the right person at the right time after Vietnam and after Watergate. Again, from my own work, I never could have been able to write anything I've written on presidential secrecy and deception without Gerald Ford allowing the House and the Senate and telling the FBI and the CIA that they had to turn over all their wrongdoing to the House and the Senate. That's the only way it's in the public record.
Well, that is quite a legacy. Then thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
John Orman, professor of politics at Fairfield University, the author of many books, including Presidential Accountability, Comparing Presidential Behavior, and Celebrity Politics. We thank Leo Duran for producing this hour and for on-air production. We thank you for listening and for calling in. And if you'd like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, you can call the radio store, 1-800-747-7444. All of our talk shows are also archived on our website, wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.